97.5 WDIX. Up. First thing in the morning. First thing in the morning.
It's all about butts with you.
If you were any drunker, you'd be playing drums for the Who.
You literally have egg on your face.
It's mornings with D-Bag and the Minge.
Happy Monday, everybody, or should I say my condolences.
Hey, not everybody hates their job.
Sure, at least that's where they keep the free coffee. Go get that coffee.
I'm already on my second cup.
And I'm on my second bump. Ladies and gentlemen, Minji's coffee cup is actually a big gulp, with enough Splenda to paralyze a mule.
Well, I like my coffee like I like my men.
So big she needs both hands.
Hey, I was gonna say rich. Someone had their Wheaties this morning.
Was that her name? Weird name for a Ukrainian girl.
Ugh. The time is 7:02. It's 42 degrees now, but it'll warm up a bit towards the afternoon with a high of 58. We've got a traffic update coming up, and at 7:15, we'll have a new movie review segment from the Fangoria Network called The Rance Macabre.
Now we go to Mitch, the glass eye in the sky. How are things looking on the bridges and tunnels, Mitch?
I didn't agree to that nickname, and I don't have a glass eye, you dick. Lots of people have amblyopia.
The traffic, Mitch?
Drivers going into the city should aim for the tunnels, as we've got delays on the Verrazano and the George Washington bridges. We got earlier word that the National Guard are conducting live practice drills on the roadways entering the city, so those delays will probably continue through the morning. Expect 10 to 15 minute delays in the Holland and Battery Tunnel, but at least they're moving. This is Mitch, the eye in the sky.
Weird.
Thanks, Mitch. We'll talk to you again in 10. Not an easy job to do without depth perception, but Mitch makes it work.
What the hell is this next segment?
The Rance Macabre. Oh, I get it. It's a play on the Dance Macabre.
And what is that?
It's a piece of classical music, you Philistine. Jesus, you work at a radio station.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are The Rance Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of The Rance Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
So we're talking about radio horror today. The idea of a sort of omnipotent voice over the airwaves sort of ruling over all the characters involved in these stories, at least in some capacity. Most of these are behind-the-scenes stories.
Right.
We're going to start off with Pontypool from 2008.
Yeah.
It's still on Netflix streaming.
It's been there forever. It's never leaving.
Yeah, I feel like I saw it almost a year ago by now.
Yeah, I saw it a while ago.
Yeah, I think we talked about it briefly in a lunch hour review, but we're going to dive in a little deeper this time around.
Right.
So it was directed by Bruce McDonald, who also directed Hellions, which is also on Netflix, but I couldn't rightly recommend that one.
I've never seen it.
It's not very good. It's very conceptual.
Okay.
I didn't think it worked. In any case, Bruce McDonald. This one, he did very well. It's written by Tony Burgess, adapted from his own novel, Pontypool Changes Everything. And for those wondering, yes, Pontypool is a community in Canada. It's outside of Ontario or within that province. Starring Stephen McHattie, who's a character actor. I always like seeing he's very distinct looking.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and he's got kind of a Lance Henriksen vibe a little bit. But in any case, Stephen McHattie plays Grant Mazzie, who's not quite a shock jock, but is plenty edgy for the small Canadian province.
He reminds me of that, who was that guy who got in all that trouble because he's a racist asshole?
The Jimmy the Greek?
No.
Was it about sports stuff? Yeah. Oh, no, Imus. You're talking about Imus.
Yeah, that's kind of how he reminds me, the way he speaks. And I think that's what he's going for.
The cowboy hat? Yeah, that is what he's going for.
Good morning, Pontypool. This is Radio 660, The Beacon. Down here in the dungeon, under the street they call Drum. I'll be banging the drum for you all morning. I'm Grant Mazzie, and as always, I'll be taking no prisoners.
So Stephen McHattie is joined by his radio producer, Lisa Howell, who, incidentally, is his real-life wife.
Oh, I did not know that.
They're very
cute together in this movie, though.
They work. It's funny, they are meant to be like an antagonistic couple, because, you know, he's the guy who can't be reined in, and she's the one whose job it is to rein him in.
And seems like she has a lot running on the station, like money or something.
It's surprisingly high stakes for how like simple and small town the radio station is. They talk about, you know, he makes a joke about broadcasting from a dungeon. She's like, it's not a dungeon, it's a church.
Yeah, it's a church basement that church they're basement. Working in. Yeah, yeah, it's weird.
Their intern is played by Georgina Riley.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very on theme. Pontypool was simultaneously made as a radio play. So they're really obsessed with the radio angle. it was originally put on the BBC's art and culture section of the World Service website. And it's way shorter. It's over half an hour shorter than the feature film. So
that kind of makes sense because, yeah, there's room for cutting.
I was thinking that.
There's a lot of room.
My original review, I thought it would make very good half hour piece to like an anthology film maybe. But as it stands, I don't know. We'll get into it. But I did like this a lot more upon second viewing.
Me and too. Because remember, I didn't like it.
Yeah, I remember. You would not have recommended it.
No, but this time watching it, I did like it a little bit more. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I think listening to it on headphones helped a lot in terms of, I don't know, appreciating the voices, appreciating the sound design. Yeah. There's actually quite a bit of
score. He's actually doing a really good job, too. There's so much going on that he's... I don't know why I hated it so much. I think because of the... I think I watched it closer to that Don Imus shit, and I was just so annoyed with the idea. And now, you know, like, I'm a... You know me. I'm an avid, like, Gawker reader and all of Gawker media, and I hate it, and it pisses me off, but I just read it anyway, and so I see kind of what he's going for with, like, piss them off, and they'll keep being engaged.
And he does it well. It seems like a very, especially these days where like the shock jock character is a staple, is just kind of like worn to death. That personality, we've heard it's just, it.
But you expect it on the radio.
And
you know?
when guys in movies are trying to approximate that, it generally reads as really false. Later, I'm going to complain a little bit about a movie called Dead Air, which does like all of these things terribly.
Nice.
So, yes. So in this case, Stephen McHattie does the job well. I think it, you know, it's a very small cast.
Yes.
It's just the studio crew and their occasional guests, of which there are very few. But yeah, McHattie is the standout of the
movie.
And
he's running the show. And I did like it so much more this time.
Yeah. I think he could definitely carry his own movie. It'd be nice to see him go from character actor to like featured guy. So sorry, we're jumping ahead. So the premise, I kind of wrote this out. I thought I might start with it, but here we are. Have you ever heard a word out loud that you can't believe is a real word? It sounds weirder and weirder the more you say it. It stops being part of a language. Now it's just a noise you make with your mouth until you move on. But what if you couldn't move on? What if the word just repeated on a loop? How long before it drove you mad? So on that note, Pontypool kind of deals with a alternate take on the zombie premise, but going back almost to like the voodoo spell style, people in a trance. And the idea being that, you know, it's crucial that this is a story being told from a radio station because audio is king, and people out there in the world are seemingly catching this like airborne auditory virus.
Yeah, yeah.
And they get a word that loops in their head or a phrase, and it sort of like trims down over time to where they're just driven insane by it because it won't relent. And so they get reports from outside. You know, it's got, I think the filmmakers talked about how there's a heavy influence on Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, the radio play.
Sure.
And they definitely do that really well. And it plays to the sound design again. But the idea that when they're taking callers in the town and like there are riots at a doctor's office and people are just going really violent and aggressive out there and everyone's scared to death. And every once in a while someone checks in with the radio station. And so we are just becoming this hub of terrible information.
Right. We're seeing it all firsthand. And yeah, it's very interesting. And he's kind of driving to work in the morning, and that's when he first kind of sees it and says, this is a weird thing.
Now, I had a strange experience on my way into work this morning, and I'd like to get some advice from you people later on. When do you call 911? Think about it.
But then he goes about his business, goes about his day.
It kind of does the Shaun of the Dead, like, bus ride, like, early morning stuff where things are happening in the background. The director, Bruce McDonald, described the stages of the virus as follows. There are three stages to this virus. The first stage is you might begin to repeat a word. Something gets stuck, and usually it's words that are terms of endearment, like sweetheart or honey. The second stage is your language becomes scrambled, and you can't express yourself properly. The third stage is that you become so distraught at your condition that the only way out of the situation you feel as an infected person is to try and chew your way through the mouth of another person. That's fucking nuts.
That's
and
gross.
I didn't get that from watching the movie.
No, I did not get that. I got that they seemed to be stuck in a loop. I got that part.
Yeah.
And then it seemed to me like they tried to just kill other people, or if they couldn't kill other people, they would just kill themselves.
Right. Yes.
That's as far as I got from that.
I never got someone trying to eat a fellow Canadian's mouth.
Me either. No way.
So that might have fallen through in terms of the
execution. Because that wouldn't kill you. And in this one section, one of my favorite parts of the movie is the obituaries that he's reading.
Yeah.
And, like, they kill all those people. Just biting my mouth off won't kill me. It's horrible and it's awful, but it won't kill me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's not. I mean, none of this is meant to be logical on the part of the infected. And that's
kind of
what.
Well, I like a little bit of logic.
We have also learned that some of the perpetrators are speaking in bizarre ways. They're babbling in ways that no one understands. And we don't know if this is a way of trying to terrorize people. We don't know.
I don't know. I think they could have done a little bit more to clarify that part because that's really creepy. That's
yeah,
just
I,
like
I kind
nonsensical
of wish I knew
impulse.
Yeah. I did not get that at all.
Yeah.
No, sorry.
But that said, like the movie works. It's very simple. It is kind of like a bottle story in terms of these characters being stuck in one location. And, you know, we as the viewer, most of our sense of the outside world eating itself happens through these call-ins and, you know, little glimpses outside.
They seem to be trying to cram themselves inside. Oh, whoa!
What's happening, Ken?
The side of the office. This building has just burst outward. It's spilling people. It just kind of exploded. Oh, Jesus! It's an explosion of people. Oh, my God! People are getting trampled. These people are getting killed down there.
You know, it's clearly like a low-budget movie made really well. And so I mentioned Bruce McDonald's other movie, Hellions.
Mm-hmm.
It is ambitious. It is conceptually challenging. I just didn't think it worked.
Yeah.
Pontypool works.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't like it so much the first time. After rewatching it, it seems like honestly something up my alley.
Yeah.
Something that I would like, but I just didn't. The second time watching it through, I mean, there's this stupid scene. It has nothing to do with anything. Lawrence and the Arabians.
Okay.
He has this musical guest.
One of those guys was the actual writer.
Yeah,
was that
yeah.
Tony Burgess?
Yeah, and so like, Mazzy has this guest come in because I don't know, he has to.
With the cell phone?
So he's like watching this. They're singing this song and it's Lawrence and the Arabians is what they call themselves, but they're like dressed up. Some people are in Middle Eastern, but the kids are not, and they're just in brown face, and it's the most awkward, weirdest shit that I've ever seen.
It's really odd, but it's the kind of thing that like you tolerate in small market radio.
Yeah, because you have to.
And so Mazzy, our DJ, literally calls his agent mid-song and like points the phone at those people and he's like, you get this shit? Like, this is what I have to put up with.
This is what I'm doing right now.
But yeah, I definitely recommend it this time around, especially Pontypool from 2008. Catch it while it's still on Netflix streaming.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely worth checking out. Do it with a more like open mind than I guess I had the first time.
Yeah, I was ambivalent the first pass, but I really came to like it. I think I was far more comfortable with the pacing the second time around. The first time I was kind of, I don't know, I felt like there was a lot of downtime. There was a lot of fat to cut in terms of the story.
Yeah, I can see how it would work as a radio play.
But it does build a nice mood. So yeah, Pontypool, check it out.
And we're back with D-Bag and the Minge.
And we're back.
Is it still Monday?
A macabre Monday, listening fans might say. Oh, you were in the bathroom during that segment.
It's 1:30 and we've got local news coming at you. The pollen index is high today. Related or not, the CDC has asked us to remind people that the best way to get through cold and flu season is to wash your hands regularly throughout the day. And if you're sick, you should stay home.
So, on that note, I gotta go.
Good luck finding an open bar at this hour. Hey!
Looks like we got a caller. Line two, we've got our old friend Barry calling from Wall Street. Hey, Barry.
What's up, Barry?
Oh, you know, just tanking the economy and robbing your 401k. Hey, did you guys get a call about school closings in the city? I just got a call from my wife about picking up my kids from school now. My day just started.
Funny you mention it. Chris just handed me a piece of paper with school closings. It looks like PS51, PS33, PS116, PS59, 35, Beacon School, Midtown West.
Basically every school in Midtown.
We don't have full details yet, but we're being told kids are being sent home.
I am officially not allowed to joke about this.
For those of you on the road, expect more Midtown traffic than usual. Now with the school buses. Parents who...
If I gotta leave work to pick up my kids because some anti-vaxxer brought their Ebola monkey kids to school, I'm gonna sue the mayor.
Right, so now we're jumping from Canada all the way over to Japan. We're going to 2005's The Booth, or it was originally called Busu. It's written and directed by Yashihiro Nakamura, and it stars Ryuta Sato playing this shock jock.
Shingo.
Shingo. He's like some sort of, he's more just like an asshole, it seems.
He's than a radio shock asshole.
Jock. Yeah, he's just like a professional annoying asshole.
I thought it was a weird dynamic that his show is like a, it's Love Lines. It's actually got Love Lines in the title.
Katsumata Shingo no Tokyo Love Connection!
And it's almost entrapment to like trick his listeners to calling in so he can make fun of them.
And I don't understand why they call in.
Yeah, I mean,
until the one caller calls, and it really kind of starts the kind of point of the film. But like, why would you call into the show?
I love. I don't anymore. I used to love call-in radio shows, and incidentally, there was a show...
You were so into radio shows.
There was a show in New York that I grew up listening to in, like, junior high and high school. And so, let's see. Love Lines is Dr. Drew, and I don't know who's his co-host these days.
No.
But,
it was Adam Carolla originally, right?
Right. Yeah. In New York, they had the knockoff Love Phones.
Nice.
And it was a woman doctor and her, you know, edgy, rugged guy who's making jokes and, at people's expenses. But I listened to that show for years. And whatever, I was a sex-obsessed teen, so it all just kind of made sense that these people's outlandish stories. And, you know, I'm just
you were like, that's true.
Shy
true,
virgin true, in New true. Jersey. But you definitely get... So these days, I'm down to listening to, like, Dan Savage's show. And I have to say, it seems at least 50% of the callers just want to feel like they're being heard.
Yes. I watch The Call on New York One. That's my jam.
Okay.
New York One is, like, our local news. And it's owned by Time Warner, and there's, like, actual production value. But the quality is actually that of... What was Wayne's
local
World?
Access?
Local access cable. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're
public
literally
access, yeah.
filming this in a closet.
They have one segment where they literally just read people the newspaper.
Don't even knock that. It's called In the Papers. And then I don't have to read the papers.
Name,
it has a name. That's the best part. But yeah, I listen to The Call and the same people call in and talk about nonsense. And half the time they don't even have a point.
No. People just, and it's funny, like I recognize the irony of a guy on a podcast being sent out
online
that like of the impulse of just wanting to be heard. And so, yeah, in this case, I mean, all his callers are generally sad sacks. I mean, it's kind of the theme of that evening is like words you can't take back. So these sort of terrible moments that rattle around your brain, like that little pebble in a spray paint can that mm-hmm. you never let go of. You're still kicking yourself over some shit you had happened to you in fourth grade. So it's off to a bad start. But we're jumping ahead a little bit. This is a ghost story.
Yes.
And
this is a haunting kind of story.
Yeah. And I dig it because it starts off as a period piece in what I'm going to guess is meant to be the 1960s. It's a mm-hmm. little tricky to judge like a Japanese radio station that's, you know, definitely vintage.
Because I think the phone is really supposed to tip us off because we're really focused on that yellow phone, the Bakelite. So if it's Bakelite, what is it? The 50s, 60s, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had one in Puerto Rico right up to like 88. So, but whatever. So in any case, in the period, in the 60s, we've got, again, like a call-in show, which strikes me as ahead of the time, I guess. I don't know. But we've got a radio DJ who is really upset by a caller who is explaining they're very close by, and what they mean is that they're in the studio with him. He's talking to a ghost.
Ooh, it's coming from inside the radio booth.
And, you know, so the lights go off, and he...
Hangs himself.
He does it swiftly.
He's a very, fast. Didn't even see that coming, actually.
No. So his studio guys are, you know, having the proper reaction and sort of freaking the fuck out, and then we cut to the present.
Right.
And so that, Studio 6, right?
Yes.
Studio 6 goes, you know, empty for the next several years. It gets a little bit of updating, but not much. It seems like everybody acknowledges that that's the haunted booth.
Right. Everyone knows, don't go there. And yet, Shingo's going there.
Yeah, so Shingo's team, I guess they talk about how they are moving stations. Mm-hmm. So everything they actually normally use is in boxes on its way to another building. So they are back in Studio 6 using all this vintage equipment.
Temporarily.
Yeah. And his engineers kind of reassure him, and they're like, this is the equipment we learned on in school. So he thinks they're going to be fine. He makes a fuss about his headphones, but otherwise they're back to business. It's the same old show.
But he's still a dick. He's a dick on the show. He's a dick off the show.
Yeah, for
a
guy.
Rude all the way around.
Without a lot of power. This is like the joke about the least amount of power going to a guy's head.
It would be like if we were assholes.
Yeah. Which, approach us, email us. We are not dicks.
No.
You can find us.
I mean, I can be
at,
if you want me to be.
Let them decide. but yeah, incidentally, we are therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Send us an email. It'll be a while still before we have call-in segments on this show.
But it would be cool. That would be pretty awesome.
So because the sound booth and the production area, that's like 70% of the movie, there is a low-budget feel to it, but you kind of forgive it. There's a little bit of a like made-for-TV film to the aesthetic.
And it's kind of strange because this is a 2005 Japanese film. And
yeah, it doesn't feel that
No, because 2000s, I mean, J-horror was so big in the 2000s, and you expect also a very certain look and feel to the movie, and this is not that at all.
Yeah, I kind of got the feeling watching it that, like, so the scares worked on me. I had faith in the storytelling. Some of the acting of the producing guys is a little questionable. I'm not sure if that was just a language barrier thing. I was reading subtitles.
I think sometimes J-horror is a different acting style, and maybe I just don't understand it in like in the American idiom of horror. You know what I'm saying? And like, it doesn't translate to me, because I felt the same way about the film where the kids, the Hunger Games. Battle Royale. Yeah, I thought, God, this acting is terrible.
Some of it probably was.
And I was like, well, maybe if I spoke the language, but I don't think so. I think it would always be terrible.
I did catch something interesting, which paid off nicely. But one of his producers, who's in studio with him, he's the guy kind of like scribbling things on the side and showing him. The guy covered his mouth when he spoke to Shingo. And I know I've seen it in like Japanese women sort of, you know, shy, covering their mouth, covering their teeth when they laugh. Like, I'm familiar with that in terms of, I don't know where I saw that, but this guy did it, and I thought, like, his character isn't especially feminine. That's a curious, like, physical gesture. And then it comes up in one of the later stories that it's his story sort of manifest to this phone call in studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, to say more would be to spoil it, but every one of these characters kind of comes full circle. And yeah, those elements work. The scares work. Sorry, this whole note started on the point of like the scares working, and the like the subtleties to the story gave me enough confidence that like the filmmaker knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
He might not have the aesthetics down pat.
Right, right.
But he knows how to tell a story. So, I mean, Nakamura has gone on to do tons more stuff.
Right.
And I think one of his films is even translated to a miniseries. So, like, the guy's a good storyteller. And the booth is a solid story. It's a good, like, haunting and ghost story. So when Shingo's on the air, they hear this specific interference in the signal. Mm-hmm. And of course, radio people are kind of freaking out in terms of like the audio behind it and what it could be. The sound is like a rusty, swinging something.
Yeah, it's kind of unclear.
So we've already been introduced to the old-timey radio guy who hung himself. And that was the first thing that came to mind in terms of like maybe someone swinging from the rafters kind of thing. But the story kind of opens up and that becomes more apparent. But he is being taunted by these voices. Well, it's one voice, right?
It's one voice.
And so the engineers don't really have an answer for how this person is like breaking in.
Because sometimes it doesn't seem that it's actually... It seems like the voice is in the room with him.
Right.
And so that's like kind of unclear.
Yeah. And so his sanity starts getting challenged and he starts kind of flipping out and seeing things and, you know, his own demons come back to haunt him. Is that kind of story. It's like the Ghost of Christmas Past kind of thing.
Exactly. Because he's a bad guy.
Yeah. It turns out he's kind of a douche. It's funny. The introduction to his character, he doesn't come off as a complete tool until he's on the air, and it's kind of like that's the moment in the evening where he's emboldened, and from then on, like even to his producers and people behind the scenes,
it never turns off. He never turns it off.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you find out through his backstory, oh, he's, you know, kind of a dick, kind of totally, absolutely a dick. There were a few things, you know, I mentioned this is 2005 J-horror, and there were certain things you expect from it, like you expect a soggy ghost walking around, and they could have had that.
Yes.
And they don't.
We...
Right?
We
I
get
was
it
excited by that because I expected
the, like,
it.
Some of the flashback element. Yeah, no. There's no proper ghost. It really does come down to
But you expect
like
it's going to be like a Samara, like some soggy ghost with this hair in front of its face. And that's not what you get. And they could have done that.
The movie doesn't... Yeah, it doesn't really have like a archetypal villain. It doesn't have an image to grab onto. That might have helped in terms of, I don't know, in terms of marketing it, but I don't know.
I kind of like that it didn't do that because, I mean, every movie at that time was doing that.
You know. Whether it's, a scary kid or someone with too
scary
much hair.
Scary ghost, scary mold that grows on my wall. I mean, all sorts of scary, soggy shit, you know?
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting, it seemed like he got really freaked out for no reason about not knowing the names of songs. I didn't understand what that represented. I didn't know if I was missing something because I told you I watched most of this in Japanese.
I couldn't really say. I think it was kind of a momentary reminder that he's losing it.
Yeah.
That he's kind of...
He like really freaks out about it. It's like, calm down, sir. Yeah. And so then I wondered, you know, is
but
that...
But also his engineers were kind of like, this was the sort of douchebaggery coming full circle where his engineers are just letting him swing in the winds. Like he's not getting any help from them.
I just wondered if, because I don't think that DJs really introduce every single song on the radio. So I wondered in Japan, like maybe they do. And so that was something I didn't understand. Like just go cut to the song, dude.
Yeah. Move on. If you don't have the name. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, you mentioned the soggy stains on the ceiling. This guy actually was one of the screenwriters of the original Dark Water.
Right. There's some soggy stains.
I guess the original name was Yoko Kuhan, The Pain.
The Pain?
Yeah.
I watched that terrible American version of it, and it was awful, awful.
I didn't think it was that bad, but yeah. The Booth is, better. I don't know. I think a better execution of concept, but...
I would like to see it redone. I wonder why this one was never redone. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know what, I think it probably, because the ones that have been redone were those, like, you know, The Ring, The Grudge, they have, like, a creepy centerpiece. Mm-hmm. That's kind of that's doing half of your marketing. Like, you just sort of cut together a trailer of scary, you know, small child moments or what have you. But this doesn't really have that. This is kind of like a paranoia ghost story, which is a lot tougher to sell.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's funny that, like, there's nothing definitively Japanese about this story.
Right.
And actually on that note, it could have easily been ported. Like it could have just been translated. This is a very nerdy point, but I could have made a big nerdy fuss about the studio equipment and how they're talking really far away on both sides of a unidirectional mic.
Nice.
But I don't know. I really, I don't know. I think this hit me in the sweet spot in terms of, I'm an audio nerd. I really do love radio. Ever since I was a kid, I love the idea of a place having memory, a location having memory. And these radio stations have voices running through microphones and mixing boards and transistors and the amplifying tower. And all these voices and all these stories are going just channeled down the same line.
Mm-hmm.
And this story kind of uses that framework to sort of catch a ghost.
Right, right.
And I really did love that element. I don't know. So maybe I kind of lost a little bit of perspective in terms of like its actual quality because I really just love the premise.
That's fine. I do that all the fucking time. Oh my God. I love Boondock Saints. It's not good, but I love it. Manic Monday? No kidding. Is it a full moon today?
Did you say full moon? I can only speak for myself.
Put your ass away, D-bag.
Party pooper. So those Fangoria kids were talking about horror movies, right? Minj, what's your favorite horror movie?
Oh, I hate being scared. I don't know. I got dragged to see The Blair Witch in college, but I had to leave before the end.
To throw up?
Yes, actually, my date and I snuck in vodka.
Big surprise.
But then, you know how the movie's all shaky? I got motion sick, and then I threw up in the popcorn, and then the lobby, and finally the bathroom. Anyway, what's your favorite scary movie?
I don't know. My wedding video? My wife didn't throw the bouquet to the bridesmaids. Instead, it was a martini. At my dad.
Whoa!
In all fairness, he did remove the bride's garter.
Wait for it.
With his teeth, without ever being asked.
Woo! During the break, though, we got an update from Mitch, our man in the sky. He saw police and riot gear setting up blockades at the Manhattan side of the Holland Tunnel.
Nothing official yet on the newswire, but we're seeing on the street photos on Twitter, and it looks like the NYPD have blockaded Canal Street. So if you're coming into the city, stick to the bridges or the Lincoln Tunnel.
Is this for real? The CDC is at the zoo now? I'm looking at a New York One report that claims the Central Park Zoo is being evacuated. Photographs from witnesses on the street show vans and trailers from the Center for Disease Control are on site.
Should we send Gorilla Greg down there? Is a suit back from the cleaners? Listeners will remember that Greg was doing flaming vodka shots at a bar appearance and forgot to take off the mask before setting his face on fire.
Way to go, Greg. Hey, looks like we might have someone calling from Central Park across the street from the zoo. Nancy, are you there?
For I have trodden them in my anger and trampled them in my fury.
Hello, Nancy.
Where blood is sprinkled upon my garments and I have stained all my robes. For the day of vengeance is in my heart and the year of my redeemed has come. I looked, but there was no one to help, and I wondered that there
was
no one to
uphold. What are you wearing?
Therefore, my own arm brought salvation for me, and my own fury, it sustained me.
Whoa, hang up
already. I have trodden down the peoples in my anger, made them drunk in my fury, and brought down their strength to the earth.
The next one I'm going to mention, but I'm not going to focus on because it doesn't really deserve all that much attention.
You told me I didn't have to watch it, so
no,
I win.
I thought we could easily call a lateral and change plays. The movie I'm talking about is 2009 Dead Air. It looks like a sci-fi production. It's not a good looking movie. Oddly, I didn't know that Corbin Burnson, the actor who I know from like Major League and Law and Order.
Okay.
Not Law and Order. LA Law.
Same shit.
He's directed a couple movies in his own right. And I hope they're better than this because this was a stinker. It was written by Kenny Yackel, who, yeah, there you go. But it stars Bill Moseley as our shock jock.
I like Bill Moseley. He's in lots of things I like.
I don't have a big problem with him. People know him as Chop Top from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and he was in Rob Zombie's Halloween and The Devil's Rejects.
Right.
I think he's generally got longer hair. He's more clean cut in this film, and he's meant to be like an L.A. shock jock. So, in that role, we've seen it a bunch. So he doesn't really bring anything different to it. There's nothing particularly sympathetic. I will say there's a very weird, it's more than a cameo, but David Moscow plays his like on-air radio buddy, Gil. And I haven't seen this actor since he was Tom Hanks' neighbor friend in Big.
Aww. He was also in Newsies.
Was he? Oh, all right. I missed that. That's Christian Bale was in Newsies, right?
I don't know who else was in Newsies. It's a musical now.
In any case, so much of the IMDb cast list is deceiving because I saw Dr. Giggles himself. Larry Drake is in this movie.
Yay.
Except no, he's on the radio calling
son of a bitch.
In a brief moment, but he's not part of the story. So yeah, this movie is a lot of misdirect in terms of it's actually terrible.
Yay!
But it has a very ham-fisted terrorist plot at its core where guys set off something at the like Staples Center in L.A., and this zombifying virus breaks out. And so, again, our radio station becomes the hub for all, you know, the details of the city going nuts and riots and everything falling to shit. It's pretty bad. There's not anything really redeeming about this. The terrorist towards the end has some pretty good lines. Like, for some reason, his lines were written the best. Maybe the actor himself rewrote them, but in any case, it's some of the only decent writing in the whole movie. Don't get me wrong. Don't see this movie. It's not good.
Okay. So the terror, though, is that it's a terrorist. It's not anything else?
Well, the people don't know that until much, much later in the story.
Oh.
What we know is that people are attacking each other in the city.
Okay.
And on that note, it does play like the movie The Crazies.
Okay. I like that. I like The Crazies.
Great movie.
Love Crazies.
Great movie. Timothy Olyphant. That's a good movie to watch. Not radio related, so don't watch it on our time.
We'll watch it some other day.
Yeah, we got to figure out a theme to bring that one up. We haven't talked about that.
Old
oddly.
And new. We can do the old and the new.
Yeah. The Romeros. Okay.
This is how we have our meetings. They kind of go like this. Just so now the listener can, it's like they're sitting in on our business meeting.
So now I'm done talking about Dead Air by Corbin Burnson. It's bad. He's not even in it. I mean, he might be a caller.
I don't even know who's in this movie.
So what is a good example of like radio done right is the podcast Welcome to Night Vale. And our listeners are probably familiar just on account of Welcome to Night Vale being a really successful podcast. And it is atypical. It is not a duo having a conversation. It is a local bulletin from a local radio station. So it is a singular narrator just detailing the like outlandish, sometimes ethereal and supernatural specters and characters that inhabit this town. But it's also matter of fact. He doesn't treat it like, holy shit, get a load of this. He's just like, well, today the green glowing cloud is over Midtown. So
I love that.
Keep an eye out. It's
That's
really
that idea that I was talking about. And there's some Mexican literature. There's a name for it, for acting like supernatural stuff is normal.
Mm.
And I don't know. If someone could just email me or tweet me and tell me what the name of that is, because there's a specific name of the genre for pretending that shit's normal. And I want to know.
Yeah. So Welcome to Night Vale does it especially well. And to the extent where they even put out a book with some of the stories from the show, and I'm sure new ones. But yeah, check that one out. Welcome to Night Vale.
It's mornings with D-Bag and the Minge.
And we're back. We've been collecting weird stories from around the city.
If you've seen something strange this morning, give us a call at 1-866-785-WDIX.
We've got a caller on the line in Midtown, and they've got some strange reports. Line 2, are you there? Whoa.
Enough with the goddamn sound effects.
What was that? Wasn't me. That was that a gunshot?
Knock it off with the crowd noise in my headphones, too.
Chris, was that a... should we call the cops?
No, seriously, knock it off with the sound effects.
That wasn't me. I think that's outside.
Don't make shit up.
I'm not making shit up. There's fucking rioting or something happening. I don't know what's happening.
I fucking hate you.
Chris, have we called the cops about the shooter?
I hate this job.
Between Halloween and Escape from New York, John Carpenter directed The Fog.
Yeah, I love this one.
The
original is a great one.
1980. Written by John Carpenter and his longtime collaborator, Deborah Hill. It ages really well.
The music's hot fire. Oh my God.
I really liked it.
So good.
I think he might have overdone it with music cues here and there. But,
what? No way. Loved it.
starring some horror royalty.
Yeah. Like
Janet Leigh.
We just talked about last week.
Yeah, and Psycho. And Tom Atkins and Hal Holbrook.
It's always a good day when you see Hal Holbrook.
This is like a who's who, like horror celebrity all-star cast with a few Carpenter regulars, Adrienne Barbeau, his then wife, and Jamie Lee Curtis.
I wonder why Karen Black wasn't in this.
Yeah, I don't know. You know what? It was relatively low budget, so I think all these people were kind of participating.
For fun.
For fun, as favors.
I see.
I mean, it was the 80s, so John Carpenter was blowing up in a hurry. I think they kind of recognized that, like, we got to get on board. This guy's going to be big. So Adrienne Barbeau is the sole radio host at the Lighthouse-based radio station.
She bought the Lighthouse. She seems to be like an implant into the city or to this town.
So she's the sole radio personality on this radio station, which, like, what is she doing? Like 13-hour shifts? Why?
I don't quite understand the logistics of this radio show. Firstly, the music's fucking terrible.
Yeah.
It's the most boring fucking radio show because she talks like she's putting you to sleep.
Well, when she's on, all right,
she's like, hey, this
might, it might be a little bit of a guy girl difference in terms of.
Oh, you thought this was cool? It put me to sleep. I was sleepy pants.
Well, the music is terrible. The music is very obviously like cheap stock music. It's all they could afford because there's quite a bit in terms of her, you know, going from one track to the next.
Right.
However, when she's on the air, she's going for sexy.
To me, it seems like sleepy. Like it's an overnight show. Like it seems to be a late night show. And
it's like the Quiet Storm.
Hey, it's really sleepy and you're probably driving late at night and I'm just going to talk real soothing until you go off the edge of the road and kill yourself.
But she's going sexy with it and there's a good amount of like double entendre in what she's saying, which like is very thinly veiled double entendre.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Adrienne Barbeau, obviously she's gorgeous, but I would never listen to this radio station in my life.
I might listen for the interstitials, But I don't know. That would be it. So Adrienne Barbeau was basing her character on Allison Steele, the night bird, a disc jockey from the 60s.
I'm Stevie Wayne, and if you don't have anything to do right now, I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. Even if you do have something to do, keep me turned on for a while, and I'll try my best to do the same for you.
And then she plays like really offbeat jazz music that doesn't really fit the mood.
It's terrible music.
Maybe that's what it is, that like it's music so bad that you can't fall asleep to it.
Right. It's terrible music.
I think I liked all the music that wasn't like music stabs during violent attacks. I liked all the mood music.
I expect that from John Carpenter, especially 1980 John Carpenter. So I said, that's fine. I'm fine with
that. Yeah, it's just John being John.
Yeah, let him do his thing. Just let him do his thing.
Yeah, Carpenter, he gave himself an uncredited cameo pretty early on as like the assistant to the pastor or, you know, Father Malone. And
that scene is like such a weird scene too, because he's like asking for his money that he's rightfully entitled to because he's working. And then the priest like cuts his hours. Doesn't give him money and cuts his hours.
Yeah, the priest kind of, he plays both like, you know, community leader and behind the scenes dick bag a little bit.
Yeah.
But the Carpenter cameo, it was the first time I had ever noticed Carpenter in one of his own films. And so I had to look it up and it turns out like he does it a lot. Like, you know, someone like Alfred Hitchcock, you kind of come to know that like that's his thing. He's going to put himself in there somewhere in the background.
Right.
But yeah, apparently Carpenter's also done it a bunch. John Carpenter mentioned two inspirations behind the film. One is the British film The Crawling Eye from 1958, which dealt with monsters hiding in the clouds, which
That's funny because I would expect like a crawling eye to be like a big gooey eye that rolls around and like zaps you with lasers. What do you think it's about?
And it might have been that. Crawling is a weird adjective to apply to monsters hiding behind clouds, but I love the idea of monsters behind clouds.
That's terrifying.
Fucking, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like something from Welcome to Night Vale. The other influence was his and Deborah Hill's experience at Stonehenge, watching the fog roll over that territory. And Stonehenge, it's already, especially like sunrise and sunset, it's got an ethereal feeling. So when the fog comes in, it does feel like a supernatural element.
Right.
And you know what? I realize we've jumped ahead. We haven't even really talked about the premise.
No, let's talk about the premise of this movie.
But it is told by the fishermen and their fathers and grandfathers that when the fog returns to Antonio Bay, the men at the bottom of the sea, out in the water by Spivey Point, will rise up and search for the campfire that led them to their dark and icy death. 12 o'clock. 21st of April.
So the very first scene in the movie, we get John Houseman scaring the shit out of, like, Boy Scouts around a campfire.
Right, and at that point in time, like, I noticed and I made a note, every single child has the exact same haircut. In 1980, boys and girl children all had the same haircuts.
Yeah, I think it wasn't until the States that I rocked a mullet. But until that point, I was kind of an 80s kid with my, like, little sort of bob.
Bob with sort of bangs cut. And yeah.
Yeah. So the story John Houseman tells the kids is about the inception of the town and these sort of wayward sailors who were tricked by the townspeople with a fire that was meant to be kind of a beacon, except it caused them to, like,
crash
the ship and they all drowned and died.
Right.
There's a curse on the town ever since then. At the strike of 12, it'll be 100 years since that time was. So, yeah, so what he's getting at is that we are at the centennial celebration of, it's not Bodega Bay.
No, it's...
Bodega Bay, I think, is actually from the birds. So it is the centennial for Antonio Bay, and that's kind of the setting where Janet Leigh is the mayor trying to get together the, like, 100-year anniversary.
Right.
And everybody in town, this is the big to-do. In the meantime, we've got fishermen out in the bay, and it's a pretty large vessel for a group of guys that are kind of... Every time they're talked about, it's kind of like they were just fucking off and fishing. Like, this was not
They're a bunch of guys
industrial
who just go out
boat.
And drink and fish.
Yeah, that's how they're described. So when they don't come back that night, everyone just assumes that, like, they got drunk and they'll come back in the morning. But something way worse is afoot. And on the centennial, the fog rolls in.
Yes.
And so Adrian Barbeau is our radio personality, sort of who can see the bay and is watching the fog come in.
Well, my gauges must be wrong. I've got a wind blowing due east. Now, what kind of a fog moves against the wind?
You got me.
I'm not so sure I want you. You're just a voice on the phone.
You know, they don't make sense of that. They just kind of write it off as
exactly like, oh, well, that's a strange thing. And then we cut to Jamie Lee Curtis now on the road.
Yeah, hitchhiking.
Yeah,
which,
she's
why
gorgeous.
Not? I
she
mean,
looks
we gotta,
amazing in this film.
We had to inject her in the story somewhere.
Exactly, and she's hitchhiking. And one of the things she says, so she gets picked up.
By Tom Atkins?
Yeah, Tom Atkins picks her up, puts her in the pickup truck.
Substantially older.
He is much older than Jamie Lee Curtis at this point in time. He's also drinking a beer and driving down the road.
It was the
80s. And yeah, apparently that's a cool thing to do. And then Jamie Lee Curtis says something like, I want to be careful. I don't want to have any, like, weirdos, and I'm a careful hitchhiker. And then he offers her the beer that he's just been drinking out of, and then she drinks out of that beer.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Are you weird?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am weird.
You are weird.
Yes.
You're weird, thank God. The last run I had was so normal, it was disgusting. He picked me up in Santa Barbara. By the time we got to Carmel, he wanted to marry me.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think you pick up a hitchhiker and instantly, like... have this kind of rapport.
She did trust him very quickly.
Very quickly to drink
out
of the beer.
For a guy who's drinking and driving and willing to pick her up in his like weird 1950s pickup truck, which if memory serves in the IMDb trivia, it might have been like a VW truck whose American nickname was The Thing.
Adrian Barbeau's got The Thing.
Oh, was that her
car?
She's
driving the thing. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, no, she's driving it. He's driving like one of those like old like S10s or whatever kind of pickup trucks. The ow was because my dog bit me. Just so everyone knows.
So Hal Holbrook is the town's priest, and we've already established that, like, his treatment of John Carpenter's character, Bennett,
yeah,
is kind of douchey.
He sucks.
It also seems like he comes from a lineage of assholes.
Yes, we do find that out. His now grandfather, he finds this diary.
So many things happening on the centennial that, like, we'll get into the fog a little bit more in a minute, but just a random piece of the wall falls out, revealing a journal and a giant gold cross behind the wall.
You know, I keep all sorts of shit behind my walls.
Who knows when it's going to come down or come into appearance. But in this case, he gets to reading, and it turns out his grandfather was just as much an asshole as he was, except murderously so.
Right,
because they allowed these sailors to crash on the shore, and then they just salvaged all their gold and stole their shit.
Nice. So, as you do when it's an American.
It's America. Every town's got some awful thing that they did at the start. But so this was Antonio Bayes. But Hal Holbrook gets it in his head, and it really struck me as odd that he's a priest. He has one singular faith, but he gets stuck on the idea that this town is cursed.
Yeah, he's really into that.
I had some problems with that, but whatever. Hal Holbrook is very good. So we get a glimpse, and it's a really great setup on the fisherman's boat when the fog comes in. That initial attack is such a great setting that John Carpenter really executes this part brilliantly in terms of the fog coming in. The guys, you know, don't make too much of it until people start appearing on the ship. And I kind of love the fog as an element where, like, it is nonsensical. We've talked about how it's not sort of playing to the rules of nature. So, you know, if you backlight it and you've got some creepy figure standing in it,
fog
it's kind of par for the course.
Blinding fog is one of the scariest things that ever happens.
Yeah. I used to live in San Francisco, and it really, I mean, the idea that it has a mind of its own is not such a foreign concept because, you would watch streets fill, and it does happen here in New York every once in a while.
It's very rare though here.
But so when the fog comes in, it does seem like this joining of a supernatural, you know, element where these ghosts live in the fog, and then nature kind of accommodating that, like, these, you know, these figures are going to course correct the evil that was done to them.
Right.
I don't know why the significance of the 100 years, I guess.
Well, because they like to make a statement, you know.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's kind of the big anniversary.
Right,
I don't know
exactly.
If that goes,
you know, like, don't waste
paper.
It on the 50. If you're gonna, like, commit this murder of 6 people, which they're after, basically these 6,
they,
like, it seems like their lineage of the founders who got them. That's the idea of the 6.
I think so, but just the same, they seem to, like,
they kill
be
anybody
satisfied. Yeah,
yeah, anybody who's around. But specifically, it seems like they're kind of going after the people's relatives that fucked them.
Yes. That said, they are very polite ghosts.
They knock and don't just let themselves in.
They need to be invited, like vampires. They need to be invited.
I was kind of unclear about that because I thought, you're a ghost, why can't you just, I don't know, like, go through the door?
Yeah, it seems like they do need to be preceded by the fog. It's funny, I was going to say the mist, but same premise applies.
Yeah.
They kind of need that atmosphere to thrive. So the ghosts are preceded by, like, great visuals of fog or mist sort of finding its way into windows
or
coming in and out of boxes at time on the ship. I thought that was a pretty cool, like, reverse footage moment.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of the visuals, yeah, because it is supernatural. You don't question that, like, there's backlighting and these figures stand out as,
well,
like, pretty
mist,
great
or the
villains.
Fog itself seems to glow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, you know, that kind
of explains
the backlighting.
You know what? Adrienne
Barbeau
never makes that much of a fuss.
Which she really should, because she can see the whole fucking bit of fog.
Yeah. It's like, hey, ladies and gentlemen, there's a radioactive cloud floating towards town.
Like, maybe you should warn us and quit playing the stupid jazz music. Quit trying to seduce my husband and fucking tell me what's going on with the fog.
Well, this is going to sound a little strange, but I saw the fog last night out in the ocean in the distance. It was glowing. Well, what seemed to be happening is that the wind was moving due east, and the fog just kept moving west. I know that sounds completely crazy.
Not right now, it doesn't.
Something happened last night. At the same time that fog was moving in, this whole town went unglued.
Yeah, she does become our narrator throughout the story, and it does lend to like the supernatural element, and also the, you know, you get like the update. It's actually funny that it struck me a little bit like a video game in terms of someone, you know, someone telling you the map, mm-hmm. like where the fog is coming, what to look out for. And then there is this sort of classic scenario where she is dislocated from her kid and right. is hoping that like someone is hearing her or her son is hearing her and, you know, find cover.
Andy, I don't even know if you can hear me. I'm sorry that I didn't come for you, that I wasn't there. Andy, please understand. I have to stay here. The fog is moving inland, away from the beach.
Yeah, that's kind of a thing that kind of doesn't actually make a lot of sense. When she's like, I'm sorry, I can't leave, to her son. Yes, you fucking can. Yes, you can, Adrian Barbeau. Get down and quit talking on the radio. No one's listening anyway.
I thought a lot of people were listening in the town. They were listening in the bar. That's unheard of.
I think like 20 people in that town. She can leave and go save her kid's life. She doesn't owe it to this town that she just moved into.
Maybe she thought of it as like a social responsibility, that I'm the only person with, you know, this reach and any actual information to the outside world and what's going on.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. That's your kid.
Okay, so
I think in that moment she knew that she wasn't going to be able to reach her kid before the fog, so she was hoping that someone would head it off at the pass.
Yeah, she kind of puts it in this weird way that makes her seem like she's Jesus Christ on earth. And I don't care for that. I don't care for that at all.
Get off your high horse, Adrian Barbeau. So the movie was in rough shape when they originally assembled a rough cut. At 80 minutes long and not scary enough, John Carpenter was starting to get nervous. But they did some rewriting. They added scenes. They added very specifically violence and close-up to some of the attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And they inserted the prologue where John Houseman scares the kids. And it's funny to think that this was a movie. It seems cohesive. And I think John Carpenter did a very good job of sort of making everything work together. And I'm surprised to hear that there was a version of this that didn't work. And in all fairness, it might have been before he scored the film. So that also kind of acts as glue.
It makes the film. The music is great on this.
Yeah. And so for a low-budget movie that was shot in 30 days, it was shot in anamorphic widescreen Panavision, which was Carpenter's call. So this low-budget movie actually looks pretty great. And mm-hmm. the special effects, and, you know, we'll always sort of hark on the idea that practical effects, more often than not, age well.
Right.
And
there's one bad worm face moment, but it's okay.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking in terms of, like, the fog itself.
Oh, and excellent. Looks
so
great.
So on the commentary and the behind-the-scenes stuff, they talk about the approach to making that and the sort of frame rate, and, yeah, it holds up. That stuff mm-hmm. is funny. Yeah, no, the monsters, I think, they always work best in shadows.
Yeah, and they're great at first until there's a few scenes where you really see some close-up monster face and mm-hmm. you wish you hadn't because they're great. You see this hook. You see these big boots. They're really tall. They're really big. And this is all done in the fog. And that's great and that's scary. And then when you see worm face McGee, it's terrible.
Yeah, sort of fades away and you're stuck with the stark reality of bad special effects, but it only happened once. from what I understand, and I don't know if I can bring myself to watch it, but there was the remake in like 2006. I don't even know. It doesn't matter.
Like I texted you the other day, and I was like, "We're not watching the remake, right?" Oh, I've never seen the remake, so maybe it's not bad. I don't know. Maggie Grace is in it, and she's in some good shit sometimes.
Sometimes
she's in terrible things.
And also
though.
The kid from Smallville, who seemingly was never heard from again.
Oh, the guy who was Superman?
Yeah,
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I never heard it from that guy again.
My memory of it was that it was never screened for the press. The studio was kind of aware that they had a turd on their hands,
mm-hmm.
and so kept it away from any critical voices before it was released.
It's on Netflix, so...
It is, and I might put it on in the background, but my memory of even the trailer is just like, that is a shit ton of CGI fog and clouds.
Just get a fog machine. They cost, like, how much? You can rent them from wherever.
The party supply store.
Yeah, go to Party City and rent a fog machine. Make your own fog. Or yeah. Dry ice. Come on.
Yeah.
Let's be practical, people.
So, yeah, there's a moment with a wooden plank that originally the kid finds and delivers to his mom and makes a fuss that at first it was a gold coin and now it's a plank. I guess she just likes the aesthetic because she brings it to the radio station. But it is just, it becomes this like totem where she's doing her thing. And then this piece of wood seems to emit water.
Yeah. And then he like ruins all of her
CDs or carts back in the day.
Yeah. I don't know what the hell those were.
And then it catches fire. Like these were just like back to back special effects that were just kind of like a neat point where like you've brought a cursed item into your
studio. Oh, when it's leaking water, that's a great practical effect. It's really great.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's for those reasons that this movie ages particularly well. That's funny. Murphy's now on my back. It's not on Netflix at the moment. I do think they just released a new Blu-ray of The Fog. And I'm sure that's got all the special edition details that I saw on DVD. So check that out, the Blu-ray for The Fog.
Yeah. I rented it on Netflix or on Amazon. I rented it on Amazon.
Okay.
So cool. It was worth it.
So that's about it for this this radio horror episode. Horror fanatics might recognize that we did not cover Play Misty for Me.
Right.
We got nothing against it, and we'll see it and check
it
out.
There was a lot more horror radio than I thought ever even existed until we started talking about, like, what are we going to include, what are we going to not include.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
Yeah. For those interested in Play Misty for Me, the Fangoria podcast, the girls in the back row, covered it quite recently, and check it out. A young Jessica Walters and Clint Eastwood's directorial debut. It was a good flick, and we'll get around to it in time, but for now, we kind of had to close it out somewhere.
Yeah.
On a high note on, John Carpenter's The Fog. So that about wraps it up for this episode on Radio Horror. We are on all the social media. Let's start with the email. We are therantsmacabre@gmail.com.
It's the closest we get to callers, listening caller people.
Yeah, we're listening. Hey. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at rantsmacabre. And our website is therantsmacabre.com, where we've always got additional content and YouTube stuff from time to time. What do you think D-Bag and the Minge are up to at this point?
D-Bag's thumb's probably up his ass, and the Minge is probably drinking.
I think the public has probably stormed the studio by now.
We can only hope.
You've been listening to The Rants Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario, that's me, and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rants Macabre, contact Ken at Fangoria.com. This is me, Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
It's Mama Mornings with D-Bag.
We interrupt your programming. This is a national emergency. The following message is transmitted upon request of the United States government. Important instructions will follow. This is not a test. A foreign invasion is occurring in the state of New York. Their intentions are unknown at this time. The following actions are being taken to ensure safety of all residents of...